Wendy Harrison. I'm the CEO of Unlimit Health. And in this episode, I will be having a conversation with my colleague and friend, Dr. Gabby Lang, who is the Senior Policy Advisor on One Health at Unlimit Health. I should say, actually, that Unlimit Health is an international organisation working to end parasitic disease. And we work really closely with affected countries, really aiming to share evidence and expertise to eliminate preventable infections. So the 7th of July is International Zoonoses Day. But why are we talking to you about this on Health Radio? Well, we wanted to take a bit of your time today to talk about how our health is really interconnected around the world, but not just with people, but also animals and the environment that we all share. And for those of you not already familiar, we'll introduce zoonotic diseases and global health and explain why we need to be more joined up and this kind of one health approach, really to achieve healthy societies, but also healthy ecosystems. And we'll also explain about how we work at Unlimit Health and how we ended up with two vets talking to you today about public health. So, Gabby, in light of World Zoonosis Day, I wonder if you could explain a little bit about what zoonotic diseases are and why we should care so much about them.
Talking about zoonosis, if we go back to the World Health Organization's definition, a zoonosis is an infectious disease that has jumped from an animal into humans. So a zoonotic pathogen might be a bacteria, virus, or parasite, and it can be spread to humans through direct contact with animals or through food, water, or their environment. And of course, for example, we all suspect that COVID-19 initially made that jump from animals, probably wildlife in this case, and into humans. And we're all sadly too familiar with now the fact that that's gone on to be human to human transmission of the virus, which has maintained its spread. So COVID-19 is a particular example that we call an emerging zoonotic pathogen. But we also have the more common kind of endemic zoonotic diseases as well, where we see the diseases passing between humans and animals as the main means of transmission. So every time it's transmitted, there's that contact between humans and animals or food. And again, that can be direct, for example, through the bite of a rabid dog or via food, such as we might have experienced with salmonella food poisoning.
Thanks, Gabby. Also, I mean, the transmission of these infectious diseases, obviously, we've seen COVID as a very recent phenomenon, but it's not actually new, is it?
No, absolutely not. Animals have been implicated in human disease from as early as the 18th century BC, and we've got Babylonian texts warning against mad dogs, which we assume refers to rabies. And then there's also advice from the ancient Egyptians to avoid unclean animals as well.
Okay, so we're dealing with quite an ancient problem here. But I wonder if you could maybe give a few more recent examples that our audience might have heard of.
Yeah, so obviously pre-COVID, people might have heard of the Ebola outbreak in West Africa, and maybe we can come back to this as well. And our listeners certainly in the UK of a certain age will remember mad cow disease, which was in the 1980s and 90s. And this was an outbreak of a zoonotic disease resulting in 178 deaths of people here in the UK and bans on British beef across many countries. And in humans, the disease was known as variant CJD, but the link with bovine spongiform encephalopathy, or BSE in cows. And the disease in humans wasn't realised until 1996. It was unfortunately invariably fatal neurological disorder in people. And once we'd realised that link between the cow form of the disease, the BSE, and that leading to human disease, they tried to control that by slaughtering 4 million cattle to try and control the spread of that disease. So really, really dramatic impact of that disease outbreak. And finally, the government realised that they had to bring in controls on feeding offal from diseased animals. Once this was identified as a kind of cause of the problem, they were using it in feedstuffs for animals. But even after we'd managed to kind of control this and control the spread of the disease, many countries stopped importing beef from the UK, which then had huge impacts on the UK farming sector as well. And in fact, China only ended their ban in 2018.
Well, yeah, thank you for that, Gabby. And actually, that's kind of interesting because that's quite a personal issue for my family, actually, who are dairy farmers in Southeast England. And we actually had a large number of cattle that had been slaughtered due to BSE. And you can imagine this caused a great deal of anxiety for my father, but also his brothers who were all in dairy farming in the area. And actually, I was at vet school at that time. So I kind of got an interesting perspective from obviously the both the kind of biological veterinary public health health side, but also the real impact that it had on the farming community. And perhaps that was actually one of the things that really sparked my initial interest in this kind of idea of the interconnectedness of animal disease with livelihoods and obviously human health. And it was kind of through that farming background that I got involved while I was working in the US with an NGO that's called Heifer International. And they donate livestock to rural communities, mainly in sub-Saharan Africa and Southeast Asia. And while I was working with them in Ruwengeri, which is a very rural part of Rwanda, it's incredibly beautiful. It's kind of nestled in between the kind of volcanic peaks on the Ugandan border. But I really saw firsthand the important role that animals could play in the health and also nutrition of people. So, for example, when kind of chickens were donated, they obviously provided really essential protein for children to prevent malnutrition, but also the sale of the eggs allowed the families to have the resources to send their children to school and get a better education and then potentially increase their sort of potential in their later lives. So from that example, I guess that was one of the things that really sparked my interest in this area, and especially in those kind of resource poor settings. So, Gabby, I wonder whether you actually can just say from your personal perspective why you kind of ended up as another vet working in probably what looks like a human health job.
Yeah, absolutely. I think probably as vets, you'll have experienced this as well. From day one, we're kind of trained to see beyond just the animal that's presented to you and think about that bigger picture. If you imagine going to a farm and going to see a sick cow, then you're taught to examine the environment around it, the bedding, the housing, the ventilation, perhaps, as well as all the other animals in the herd. Are there other animals that are sick? Is there a particular characteristic? Is it a particular age group affected? And then also the farmer's own health as well. Has anybody in the family been affected? Are there any rashes or have the farmers been ill themselves? And then as well, you'd pair that up with the clinical exam information that you'd be getting from that particular animal. So you very much kind of take a holistic view of health. I think vets are really well trained to see that. And for me, I have a similar story to yourself, I suppose. I was doing my PhD research out in Ethiopia, looking at the health of working horses. And with working horses, there isn't necessarily this direct zoonotic disease risk. You know, there's not a pathogen that's going to jump from horses into people for the most part anyway. And actually, it was really about understanding how these animals' role fit into the livelihoods of people and the societies. You know, people were telling us if their horse isn't fit to go to work, then they can't use it in a taxi business or to get the kids to school or to help them to carry water back from the water places. And that makes the difference between them being able to afford healthcare or school fees or food. So there really is this kind of wider impact of animals beyond just the zoonotic disease impact. And that's really where I thought it was important to kind of look at how we encapsulate that. How do we make sure that we consider those wider roles when we're thinking about health structures or policies and welfare services? And that's really where I got interested in how policy also helps to bring this big picture thinking into the health world in a more official sense.
I think that this whole area now has kind of, the phrase One Health has kind of been coined. And I know that people might not be familiar with that term. So I just wondered if you could explain your perception of what One Health actually is.
I think One Health concepts, they might sound very technical, but really it boils down to common sense. People don't live their lives in neat silos according to human, animal or environment health all being separate. And in fact, most of us are interacting with animals and plants in a shared environment nearly every day. So we really need an approach that's going to reflect and a policy that's going to reflect that. And this is what the One Health approach tries to do.
We actually first met, didn't we, when you were working on One Health policies in the UK government. I wonder whether you just want to say a little bit about that.
It was a really interesting time. I was working for, we have one vet in the House of Lords who's a crossbencher. He's there for his expertise. And I think veterinary advice and that perspective, the big picture perspective, it means that he was able to speak to a great broad range of subjects within Parliament. And his advice was always well received. But I think the reality of it is that it's very difficult to work across disciplines. There's many different languages that we use. We work in different ways. Maybe we work on different timescales if you compare people looking at cancer prevention to people who are looking at climate change. You know, there are lots of differences between our sectors and how our disciplines might work. But really, it was an example of around Ebola when we were talking more about the outbreak there, when you started to see just how important these policy structures were and thinking about the big picture in disease outbreaks and how that can play out on the ground. Now, our listeners might need to remember back to 2015 and the Ebola outbreak that happened in West Africa. And one of the things that came up was the impact of fishing policy. Now, seemingly, there isn't an obvious link between fishing and the Ebola outbreak. There's no direct zoonotic disease transmission between fish or seafood, for example, and people. But actually, you know, changes to the common fisheries policy that were happening in the European Union in Brussels at that time could arguably have contributed to one of the largest outbreaks of Ebola, some 5,000 miles away in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. And what happened was that the Sustainable Fishing Partnership allowed EU fishing rights in third countries, which included West Africa. And again, another policy issue, illegal fishing. If we combine that with the fact that these waters have been newly opened to third parties, we're dealing with depleted fish stocks, perhaps endangered marine ecosystems. And this all reduces the amount of fish that was available for what were, you know, traditional fishing communities in the locality of these countries on the coast. And this would normally be their primary source of protein. So if you're faced with a protein shortage, you're obviously going to have to go and look elsewhere for that and for your livelihood as well. So people were turning then away from the coastlines and towards the jungle, and that resulted in them hunting bushmeat or some of the more wild animals that are out there in the forests. And that, of course, brings them into contact with wild animal species that were potential vectors of Ebola virus. And then sadly, you're well aware of the rest of that story. But there's other things that could have been at play as well during that Ebola outbreak. Factors such as deforestation or climate change can really increase the risk of those emerging zoonotic diseases, where there's that one-off event where it jumps from animals to humans, and then the kind of human-to-human transmission means that we're really facing big outbreaks. For example, when there's erratic weather or deforestation, it can reduce the amount of food sources that are offered by the forest, and it can mean that the animals and humans are then both competing for fewer resources and coming into closer contact, and again, then we have this higher risk of those viruses or other pathogens making that jump. So I think it's really important that we commit to this holistic One Health lens that goes right from the top, from global health policies like the international pandemic treaties that we're negotiating at the moment, right the way down to that community level health, where we might then be picking up on people's interactions with animals in their daily lives. And so, Wendy, I think coming back to you, listeners might be interested to understand a bit more about what Unlimit Health as an organisation does and how we're trying to keep to those principles of One Health.
Thanks, Gabby. Yeah, and I think from the kind of organisational perspective, we're really interested in how these kind of global policies that you've just been talking about and other events in other sectors impact on our mission to eliminate preventable parasitic diseases. So one of the parasitic infections that we really focus on is called schistosomiasis, or you might have heard of it being called bilharzia or even snail fever as well. And this actually affects approximately 240 million people globally. And these are at risk of schistosomiasis and actually require treatment. And 90% of those are in Africa. So this is an enormous number of people. And especially when you compare that to something like HIV, which in Africa is thought to affect about 30 million people. So it's 240 million people that are at risk of being infected with this parasite. And this is a waterborne parasite. It reproduces in freshwater snails, and the larval form are then able to burrow into intact skin. So just by coming into contact with contaminated water when you're washing clothes or swimming, you can get infected. So you don't need a cut, you don't need any lesion, basically just an intact skin being in contact with that contaminated water, you can become infected. And the parasite then travels in the blood and it settles in the blood vessels around the urogenital or the gastrointestinal tract. And this causes really chronic organ damage. And in the urogenital tract that obviously sits around the bladder and the genital organs, that can actually significantly increase the risk of HIV being contracted by women by up to fourfold. The main impacts of the disease are actually seen in children. And as you can imagine, this really has a significant impact on their ability to attend school and learn. And the life cycle is actually then completed when the eggs in feces or urine enter the water. Now, some species of schistosomiasis can be carried by animals, such as water buffalo, but also what we're seeing is an emergence of what's called hybrids, where the cattle species of schistosomiasis, which is quite separate, and the human species are starting to reproduce together. So this means that you could potentially have cattle acting as a reservoir for infection. So you can kind of see that with this very complex life cycle of the parasite, there's really many points that can influence the transmission of the disease and also our ability to control it. So one of our key interventions is to support the Ministries of Health to identify where there are high risks of infection and also to distribute medicines that are actually able to kill the adult parasite. So in Zanzibar, we've been working with the Ministry of Health actually for several decades. And although, you know, when you say Zanzibar, for many people that conjures up beautiful white beaches and palm trees and tropical cocktails, it's actually one of the most resource poor parts in sub-Saharan Africa. And due to Zanzibar's real reliance on imported food, and obviously with the global increase in commodity prices, the Zanzibar government actually have a policy to build 5 new dams to really increase the rice production and obviously try and support economic growth. But these dams actually create the perfect breeding site for freshwater snails and also increase the potential for people and animals to come into contact with that contaminated water. So that government policy, also coupled with one made by the UK government to make significant cuts in funding to international development aid, including the support that they give to the drug distribution as part of the Zanzibar Schistosomiasis program that we also support on, really has meant that those strides that we've taken towards tackling schistosomiasis was significantly hampered, really resulting in an increase in the infections rate and, of course, the debilitating symptoms in the Zanzibar community. So you know, we're really interested in a very real way with how those kind of policies in different sectors and by governments around the world actually have a real impact on people that are suffering from these diseases and our ability to support the Ministries of Health in trying to tackle those. I think it might also just be worth mentioning at this point that schistosomiasis is part of a group of diseases that the WHO has called the neglected tropical diseases. And these typically affect communities in very resource-constrained settings, and that's mostly in sub-Saharan Africa and Southeast Asia. And although these diseases actually have very little in common in terms of their biology, because they're caused by a really wide range of different pathogens, viruses, bacteria, and parasites, but what links them together is that they all affect populations really living with very limited access to basic services in really resource-poor settings. And many of the political and other changes affect the distribution and control of a number of these neglected tropical diseases, as well as schistosomiasis.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Apples and pears, beef and skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, Ant and Deck, fish and chips, mum and dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com.
strawberries and cream.
Once upon a time, human slavery was just a fact of life. Right now, animal abuse is often considered normal. In time, it won't be. Animal Aid campaigns peacefully against all forms of animal abuse and promotes cruelty-free living.
Check out animalaid.org.uk. It's time for a kinder world.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
That's really helpful. Thanks, Wendy. Really interesting to hear and just how complicated the situations can be. And I know that Unlimit Health focus mainly on Africa, where prevalence is highest. We've also seen this parasite moving to new countries as well. Most recently, yes. There was an outbreak closer to home on the French island of Corsica. But there is good news, and it does sound like, you know, we're facing high prevalence and people in high risk. But there's been excellent news out of Benin and Mali, and another neglected tropical disease, as you described this group of diseases kind of been grouped together. Another one is trachoma, which is an eye disease caused by an infection. And if it goes untreated, it can also lead to an irreversible blindness. It tends to occur in places similarly with inadequate hygiene, crowded households, places with inadequate access to water and sanitation. So a lot of the similar drivers that for across a lot, the different neglected tropical diseases. But as of the last year, 15 countries have eradicated trachoma as a public health problem. And this has really been a concerted effort for these diseases to get to elimination stage. So what do you think about schistosomiasis? Could it actually be eliminated?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think if you ask the World Health Organization, they would definitely think that it can, because in 2012, the World Health Assembly passed a resolution that was obviously backed by all the member states of the WHO to eliminate schistosomiasis. And in 2012, the WHO produced a roadmap detailing for schistosomiasis, but also the other NTDs, how they could actually reach elimination. And the second iteration of that roadmap was launched in 2021 that really tried to lay out what the steps were needed to be taken to reach elimination, and also kind of including all the different stakeholders, the ministries of health themselves in countries that are affected by these diseases, but also supported by governments from the global north that provide international development aid, and also organisations like ourselves who are set up to really try and support ministries of health and share the kind of expertise and knowledge that that we've gained from working in this environment for some time. And I also just again might be helpful for listeners just from our organisational perspective, that we actually started our life in Imperial College in London in their School of Public Health as a research project that was supported by actually one of the very first Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation grants, really to prove the concept that you can control elimination at that stage on a national scale, because before then there really hadn't been any national scale programs. There were just sort of very small pockets. And so all the research that we did to look at actually how you do that at a national scale, now we have, having worked in this space for over 20 years, really, we want to make sure that we transfer that knowledge, to our Ministry of Health counterparts, but also hugely importantly, that we learn all the context from those Ministry of Health colleagues to really kind of understand how this disease can best be tackled. So very much about, sort of sharing that knowledge from the different perspectives. So the WHO have really helpfully laid this out in these documents, that, as I said, were launched in January 2021, and kind of detail out to 2030 the steps.
How do we translate that, high level strategy into what actually needs to be done to make this happen?
Yeah, absolutely. And that, of course, is the multi-million dollar question. And, I think that, as we said, really one of those very key interventions is still around to eliminate schistosomiasis, is still around the drug treatment. And as I mentioned before, you know, this can be given annually and it can kill the adult parasites. So therefore, it kind of reduces the eggs in the environment, as well as, you know, hugely importantly, reducing the symptoms experienced by the people infected. And currently, those drugs are actually donated free of charge by pharmaceutical company Merck, which is a absolutely amazing kind of philanthropic act from the pharmaceutical company. But the cost of the distribution of the drug has to be raised by the Ministry of Health, and often with support from external funders, and often through organisations, you know, like ours on Limit Health. But external funders often focus on treating children, understandably, because these are the ones who experience the most symptoms and are obviously exposed to the really chronic effects of infection. But if we're going to eliminate schistosomiasis, we obviously have to treat all the population at risk, because otherwise those people that aren't treated then just act as a reservoir to then reinfect the children or people that have been treated. So that's really important to treat those other populations. And they're often people that come into contact with contaminated water. So people like fishermen, who obviously spend a lot of time in the water, or also women that are washing clothes or dishes in unsafe water. But also, a lot of work's been done to look at, actually, is just using treatment going to be able to reach that target of elimination that was set out way back in 2012? And the results suggest that actually just treating people who are infected won't actually be enough. We really need to focus on actually preventing that treatment in the first place. And of course, you know, that also prevents people having to go through those, having the symptoms of the disease. And so, as you remember from the life cycle, a key factor is the environment. And we need to ensure that people are not coming into contact with that contaminated water. And one of the ways of doing this is obviously to improve the sanitation, so that the eggs in the feces and urine never get into the water courses. And people that are accessing the water to do their everyday chores or for their livelihood don't carry the risk of being infected. And so, but obviously having access to good sanitation and clean water is essential, not only for disease control, but if you are able to buy good latrines and clean water and in areas where you've got high schistosomiasis, then people obviously both have their human rights fulfilled, but also can be protected from the diseases. So it's very much about using the resources that are already available, but targeting them in the most effective way. And snails are also an important part of the life cycle, as you remember. And those freshwater snails can actually amplify the number of larvae in the water thousands fold. So we really need to look at the control of the number of freshwater snails. And as we saw in Zanzibar, there are other infrastructure projects that potentially are very beneficial to the communities, but also can inadvertently provide habitats for snails and actually increase the risk of infection. But when we think about how to reduce the number of snails, we also need to think of that in a very holistic way, because several of the chemicals that have been shown to be very effective at killing snails also have an impact on fish and also the whole aquatic ecosystem. And so although they reduce the snails and schistosomiasis, they can also reduce the community's livelihood and also their ability to get protein as well. So it's really important to think very carefully, again, as we've been seeing, at the consequences of everything that we do on all different sectors, rather than just focusing in on the impact on human health. But Gabby, I know that you've actually been looking at some other ways of snail control. So I wonder whether you wanted to say something about that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think when we're looking at the control of schistosomiasis, it's really important to think about all the different ones. I don't think there is a magic silver bullet where one method is going to be able to do it for everybody. So thinking about all these different points of control that we've got around the clean water and the praziquantel treatment in people, but also, you know, controlling those vectors and the snails, and in doing so, making sure that we're not doing any harm as well at the same time. So there's some lovely examples where native freshwater shrimps have been looked into, so that the shrimps will naturally predate on the snails. And in doing so, they will not take the schistosomiasis on and become infectious themselves. So that stops with them. And the shrimps then are also, while being native to the water systems in a lot of countries already, but also could provide livelihoods and nutrition as well, if that's something that people want to eat. Other methods that they've looked at as well is around habitat clearing. So obviously we don't want to go in and say we're going to clear all of the vegetation from a freshwater lake, for example, because that's not going to have a good impact on the ecosystem overall. But there are ways of looking at habitat clearing in areas of high risk, for example, where the children are particularly using that to swim and play in, or whether women are particularly using that area to wash clothes in. And of course, all of these interventions, when we're looking at reducing the snails and that life cycle as well, and the clean water, all they will have impacts on human health, but also on the animal health as well. We talked about cattle schistosomes as well. And I just wondered whether I could give you an example of where taking this holistic approach, it's always like, sounds like a nice to have, but actually it's really essential, because when we don't do it, there are some really terrible consequences. And guinea worm is one of those examples, one of those neglected tropical diseases, and one where there unfortunately is the opportunity for those guinea worm to live in dogs as an animal reservoir. And when they were controlling guinea worm and trying to eliminate this as a human health problem, they were focusing all of their control efforts within people and didn't really pay any attention to the fact that dogs could also harbour the guinea worm. And in doing so, they got really, really close to eliminating the infection. And then suddenly we started to see it creep back. And that was because as people reduced the efforts to control the guinea worm in people, because the prevalence had dropped much lower at that point, then, of course, the parasite was able to come back out of the animal reservoir and cause reinfection and again start that life cycle. So really important that we, you know, all of these efforts we make, all of the gains that we make towards elimination aren't lost because we've neglected one part of that transmission cycle. And I suppose that we'd be really interested to see how Unlimit Health is supporting the efforts to reach that target of eliminating schisto that the World Health Organization has set, and how are we using a holistic One Health approach, Wendy?
So as I said, in various different guises, we've been working in this area for about 20 years, actually supporting our Ministry of Health colleagues. And actually last year, which is our 20th anniversary, we had supported the delivery of 1 billion treatments to people at risk in over 15 countries. And we've raised over $100 million to support the distribution of the drugs that, as I said, are donated by the pharmaceutical company Merck. So we're obviously immensely proud of that, but we also know that, you know, we need to take further strides and really embrace this holistic approach, you know, as an organisation. And we really have spent time developing policies and tools to really support the coordination with those other sectors that are, as we said, so essential to prevent and ultimately eliminate schistosomiasis. So we've worked very closely with the water, sanitation and hygiene sector, so that resources that have been allocated to support, you know, better latrines and water quality can really be directed to areas where there is very high risk of schistosomiasis, and also really understand from the water and sanitation sector, you know, what are their key impacts and how we can work very closely with them so that they can achieve, you know, their goals and we can also achieve our sort of disease control goals. And we've also understood that it's really important that the communities that are affected are actually the real centre of developing how these interventions are actually implemented, so that it can really align with what their needs are. And I think we see in many situations where, with the very best of intentions, external resources and people come in and try and put in latrines or water sources, and actually they're not used and they're not maintained by the community, because actually they really are either not in the right place, or they're of the wrong type of construction, or there wasn't enough understanding from the community of how they were to be utilised. So it's just really important to make sure that the communities are absolutely the centre of how we work. And we've had some really great results from projects in Uganda, of really the starting point being talking to the community about, you know, how we can best support them to have access to good sanitation and good water quality. And so we're also really exploring how we can better coordinate with the veterinary public health sector, as we've talked about a bit before, exploring that idea that cattle can potentially harbour hybrid species. So really kind of looking at how we can prevent that, but also sort of aside from just looking at that kind of zoonotic disease piece, which is obviously where we started our talk today, but also think about actually how we can utilize the resources that we have in a better and more impactful way. So I guess as a kind of good example of that is that we're working on a parasite that's called Tinea solium. It's also known as pork tapeworm. And this is a parasite that infects people when they eat undercooked contaminated pork. And the tapeworm then develops in the intestine. And obviously that reduces people's ability to absorb nutrients. But it also pumps out a huge quantity of tapeworm eggs in the feces. And then if pigs come into contact with infected human feces and they ingest the eggs, then obviously the cycle starts again. And in many of kind of the resource poor settings that we work in, pigs are often free roaming. And in situations of obviously poor access to latrines, the pigs will often come into contact with human faeces. But there's also another slightly more sinister route of infection. And this is when people ingest the eggs. So this often happens, obviously, if there's poor access to water for hand washing, or where human feces actually used as fertilizer on crops, and then it's not washed properly. And the eggs then hatch, and they form the cyst inside the people rather than in the pig. And in people, the cysts form in the brain rather than in the muscle, which is what happens in the pig. And the cysts within the brain are all depending on what part of the brain they develop in, and also how many of them there are, can cause epilepsy, but they also can cause very severe neurological problems and can even be fatal. And actually, T. solium is the most common cause of acquired epilepsy globally. But really interestingly, Tinea solium can actually be treated by the same drug as schistosomiasis. And so we, with other partners, including the pharmaceutical companies, are exploring how we can identify areas where both of the diseases are present and how we could modify our existing program that obviously just at the moment targets schistosomiasis to treat both the diseases at the same time. And also by improving the access and use of good quality latrines and water can also help to tackle both diseases. So, and it's also crucial that the effects from the human side, so improving access and use for good quality latrines and water, helps tackle both diseases. And so it's crucial that the efforts from the human side are linked with the efforts on the veterinary side, because obviously they're tackling this from the treatment of pigs, better inspection of pork meat before it gets into the human food chain, and supporting farmers to actually contain their pigs to prevent them from having contact with human feces. But this is obviously a trade-off, because one of the reasons that families actually keep pigs is that they can go out and forage, and so there's little cost to actually feeding them, and they can provide a very high valuable source of protein, but also they can be sold when needed. And the veterinary workforce is also very important in sharing knowledge about these and other zoonotic diseases with the community, and are really important in giving information for both, you know, humans and animals. So not only is it important that we coordinate with other sectors, but it's also crucially important that the efforts to control and eliminate schistosomiasis really are not a standalone program that's sort of entirely externally funded, but that's really part of the national health systems.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Animal Aid campaigns peacefully against all forms of animal abuse and promotes cruelty-free living. We've been doing this for over 40 years. Every year, More and more people are living satisfying lives completely cruelty-free. Check out animalaid.org.uk. It's time for a kinder world.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
And I think maybe now would be a good time to revisit what we mean by a health system as well, because I think that's come up a couple of times. So according to the World Health Organization, a health system consists of all the organizations, the people and the actions whose primary intention is to promote, restore or to maintain health. And here I shall infer that it's for human health. But this definition also includes efforts and influences for any upstream determinants of health as well. So I feel like it could easily become a one health system that we're talking about, which would then include environmental, plant, animal health too. But I might be biased.
We've always kind of worked very closely with the national governments, really to make sure that all our interventions and progress are an intrinsic part of that national system, because that's so important for the sustainability of the control efforts, and especially as we recognise how long it's going to take to actually reach that goal of elimination. However, working in this way through the national health system also has the added benefit of not only tackling SHISO, but also to strengthen the whole of the system. So that this means that they're much more resilient and can deal with other emerging threats and outbreaks, such as we've seen with obviously COVID, Ebola, and a whole range of other health threats. And one of those examples might be the sort of strengthening of data systems that are used for surveillance, which obviously we do for schistosomiasis, and also the laboratory capacity, so that we have better diagnostics that obviously can be used for a whole range of different diseases, but also across a range of different species. So, and I really like what you said about the health system becoming a one health system, and I'm also very biased, so and I think that Unlimited Health is really trying to do just that, helping really to support in areas where we need to coordinate between different parts of the health system or with other sectors that are not necessarily seen to be part of that system currently. And for example, the public health work will work with lots of shared areas of interest and skills, just like I mentioned with surveillance and laboratory diagnostics, for instance. And I know that, Gabby, actually, you've been working with the World Health Organization recently on really trying to make the most of these kind of shared areas. So I wondered if you wanted to just say a bit more about that.
Yeah, I think it's absolutely critical to have a strong environmental and veterinary health systems alongside the human health system if we're really going to prevent and mitigate some of these complex global health challenges that we're seeing now and we're going to see more of in the future. So future pandemics, the impact of climate change, for example, and maybe what people are calling the silent pandemic of antibiotic or antimicrobial resistance as well. These are really complicated issues that need a kind of complicated response. So I've been helping to develop a bit of a tool for national governments to use to help them understand their health workforce as one element of these responses. And we're trying to make sure that the assessment will look across all the disciplines and all the sectors as well, to consider the skills and competencies that the workforce might need on a kind of broader scale, more holistically. And this might be really useful, for example, when we've got outbreaks or pandemics and we need that surge capacity for people who are trained in vaccinations. They could easily be veterinary animal health workers to work alongside the human health, for example, or likewise, human health workers that might be trained in vaccinations could also help in an animal health outbreak. We've also got epidemiologists who are studying all kinds of different data and understanding disease modelling and things. Again, it doesn't matter where that data is based on, the environment, animals or humans, it's a lot of the same skills. Biosecurity, again, understanding that across sectors is really critical. So those skills are very similar no matter what species you're working in, and we can hopefully make the most of that fact.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think, you know, as we've said throughout, really coordination between sectors, although absolutely desirable, it can actually be really quite difficult. And also between ministries, you know, within governments as well. As you were mentioning earlier, Gabby, when you were telling us about your time in the UK government, it just comes back to how important it is to work through national governments. Because if we want to have effective and widely accessible health services, this can only be built when health system priorities and actually their funding are directed by the endemic countries themselves, because they're the ones that are really best placed to understand the needs and the priorities of their own populations. And this is actually a really important shift from more traditional ways of working, where there's big charities or funders who will decide what to spend the money on and where to spend it. And I think a real move away from that to a much more listening kind of mode and really understanding the needs and being able to respond to those needs is absolutely crucial. Our new strategy that runs out to 2028 has really taken this to its heart, and we really aligned our targets and goals with those set under the Sustainable Development Agenda and also those set by the WHO, which have obviously all been endorsed by the member states of the WHO. And so our real drive now is to do all that we can to put our expertise at the service of our endemic country colleagues.